Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am one of the hosts of the channel, Shatranjay Maul. Today I'm speaking with Professor Isabel Wakuha Alonso about her new book, Radio for the Millions, Hindi-Urdu Broadcasting Across Borders, which was published by Columbia University Press in 2023. Professor Wakuha Alonso is an assistant professor in the Department of Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies at Columbia University. She is a historian of sound media and modern South Asia. So welcome to the podcast today, Isabel.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. A pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great to speak with you today. So our first question is always biographical. So I'd like to ask you about your background. Where did you grow up? And how did you become a historian of South Asia with an interest in sound media?
Oh, thank you. I always find it a little odd for me to start with my background, because it might be a little bit unusual for this kind of for the kind of research that I did. But I was born in Mexico City, and I grew up on the U.S.-Mexico border on in the city of Nuevo Laredo. And then later, I moved to Laredo, Texas, which is just across the border. They're sister cities. And that's sort of my I really grew up in on the border area, but my family is from Mexico City. So I travel a great deal to Mexico City to visit family. As to how I became a historian of South Asia, it's a very long story. So I'm not sure you want to hear all of it. But the short part of it is that I began when I wanted to go to grad school. My idea initially was to do comparative research. I wanted to do comparative research in the social sciences between Latin America and South Asia. And I was interested in questions of gender, but I wasn't sure what approach to take. And I did a master's in South Asian studies, hoping to learn languages. I began to learn Hindi and later Urdu. And then my idea is that I was probably going to do something in political science and sort of do comparative work. And then I moved away from that. I really I decided that I really enjoyed history as my main field. And I moved away from the idea of comparative work and became really interested in modern South Asian history. I really enjoyed my language classes and was really realized that that's where I wanted to go. So it was a gradual move to South Asian history. And as to a radio project, that also came about in a rather unconventional method. I began by proposing a project about Subhash Chandra Bose specifically and the Indian National Army. And when I began looking at sources for that, I became most interested in his radio broadcasts and sound sources. And then I realized that I was most interested in media itself. And then I really began to change the trajectory of my research and realized that what I found most interesting was radio broadcastings and questions about radio broadcasting. And that section that was the initial initial whole project became a section of the book, of the then dissertation and now the book, a single chapter. But that's sort of Nothing was planned. It all sort of developed slowly. And as to the focus on borders, I think that sort of came very intuitively. I didn't plan that. It's just the questions I always asked were about borders, because I am from a border, right? And it just, to me, it made sense at the time that there was no other way to approach a study of radio broadcasting that looked at Hindi and Urdu, which were the languages that I was learning, that was not across borders. And it just, those were the questions that I asked. You know, and because I did that, that was sort of, because I had that background, that was sort of the focus that the study took, without, in a very, almost in a very organic manner. I didn't consciously think it like that at the beginning of the study.
Thank you for sharing that. I mean, for the field of South Asian history, it's great that you became a historian with this focus. And I feel like your perspective and your background sort of enriches the field. And of course, and it's also fascinating to hear about how your own experience growing up along the border sort of contributed to sort of being interested in South Asian history, because like borders is a big theme in modern South Asia. So I think you've already touched upon this a little bit, but I'd like to turn to talking about your new book, Radio for the Millions. So it's a deeply fascinating cultural history of South Asia that uncovers the role that radio media played in the region's politics and society. So how did you come to write this book, and what do you see as its major arguments and contributions?
How did I came about to write it? So it began as a dissertation, as I mentioned, and it was done in a history department, but in conversation with media studies. And afterwards, I think that it became more and more in conversation with sound studies. And right now I see it as a book that brings together South Asian history, modern South Asian history specifically, and sound studies, and ask that they should be read in conversation. And I would say that there's a number of arguments in the book itself, but the main argument of the book is that despite the state governments, both the colonial government and the independent Indian and Pakistani governments, many attempts to use the radio for their own purposes, the medium was much more successful at contesting that. And I show the various ways in which that happened. There's also a very important linguistic argument. A lot of the scholarship has argued about how Hindi and Urdu become separate languages associated with separate religious communities in the years leading to the 1947 partition. And this book shows that if you pay attention and listen, instead of only look at written sources, there's a very different story to be told. And then the book, as I had mentioned, is also very much in conversation with works on sound studies and radio studies specifically. And it makes an argument about how we might look at how radio engaged with audiences. And it specifically argues that radio's power was beyond those who would listen to it or could tune into it, but that there was also very important the ways in which radio allowed people to talk about radio broadcasting. And it develops the concept of radio resonance, specifically to talk about the ways in which talk, rumor, and conversation allowed radio broadcasts to reach further than actual receivers would have. And this is important in an earlier time period when radio receivers were not as available, but it also remains important in the age of the transistor, for example. Mm-hmm. Right. So I would say that those are the leading arguments of the book. And of course, there are some arguments within the various sections that we can talk about.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing. And we can sort of talk about some of the other sub-arguments as we go through the chapters and the sections, which I'll just talk to you about in a moment. But before we go into the sections and chapters of the book, I wanted to ask you something that I like to ask all my guests, which is about their research for the book. So where did you do your research, and what sorts of archives and sources did you access?
Yeah. This has been an ongoing project for about a decade. And as to research, one of the difficulties that one faces with working with radio archives or radio broadcasting in general is that sources are not easily available. It's hard to gain access to radio stations recordings. Many of the radio stations actually would broadcast live and we wouldn't have access to that. So I really had to do a combination of everything possible. I worked in a number of sort of traditional archives. I did work at the Indian National Archive. I worked at the British Library. I worked at the National Documentation Center in Pakistan. But then I also relied greatly on oral history interviews with radio broadcasters and devoted listeners. And throughout India and Pakistan, I traveled a great deal for it. That allowed me to also access their own personal archives, recordings that they had, but also letters that sometimes they kept from radio listeners, diaries that radio listeners shared with me. It all depends on the chapter. But what I would really say here is that I really went wherever I possibly could to trace those sources. And it required a lot of time and work. But I hope that the book will show the value of that.
Absolutely. I mean, as I was reading the book, I sort of felt how rich it was and how you had accessed so many sources from so many different countries. And I think that that sort of really made enriched the book and made it such an interesting read for me. So now I'll turn to sequentially asking you about the chapters of the book. So in chapter one, you trace the origins of radio in 1930s colonial India and its role in shaping knowledge about World War II in India, starting with its outbreak in 1939. So could you tell us a little more about this?
Yeah, so the first section of the book, which is chapters one and two, focus specifically on radio news and World War II. And what the argument that the first chapter makes and sort of what became very clear in my sources is that World War II was a breaking moment for radio broadcasting for a variety of reasons, but the most important one, because the British administration was terrified that anti-colonial leaders would use radio broadcasting for their own means. Radio was quite restricted in India prior to World War II. But despite the fact that there were not many radio receivers, as soon as the war broke out, and even a little earlier, when various access countries began broadcasting in Indian languages, sort of interest exploded. And people really began to tune in to these radio broadcasts. So the chapter talks about the ways in which this was a turning point for radio, and the ways in which broadcasts first from Germany and later from Japan really made people very interested in radio. And the reasons why these broadcasts were popular, one of the reasons is that they showed solidarity with the nationalist movement. Of course, that's a very complicated solidarity that's discussed in the book, but it's one that listeners felt that they could get access to that kind of broadcasting that they couldn't get from All India Radio, for example.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a very fascinating chapter. It sort of connects with some of my interests about the connections between India and Japan. And
that's right.
That sort of also connects with the next chapter of your book, which covers the very fascinating and complex anti-colonial leader Subhash Chandra Bose. So in this chapter, you focus on his radio persona and add new layers to the study of him as a historical figure. So many in our audience may be familiar with Bose, but there also may be those who are not familiar with him. So could you tell us more about him and his role as an anti-colonial radio personality during World War II?
Sure. I mean, I cannot say his entire biography in this short thing, but what I can definitely say is that there is a large scholarship on Subhash Chandra Bose. And what that scholarship around has often been telling us is about him being an anti-colonial leader with a larger history who during World War II goes to Germany, receives help from Germany, aligns himself with the Axis, later with Japan, right? And then fights with the Indian National Army. And what I try to do in this particular chapter is to listen to his radio broadcast in the context of what else is going on in the radio. And what that really reveals is that the narrative of his alliance with Japan and Germany, which has always been said as a narrative that says that it was only that there was that the only reason why he aligned was out of self-interest, and that there was no ideological reason to align, fails to see the ways in which his radio broadcasts were perceived in the larger context of Axis propaganda. Right. And this particular chapter puts it in that larger context of Axis propaganda and says that he was part of that larger context of Axis propaganda in Indian languages to India during World War II. And the chapter also, and I should mention that the chapter also puts that, like I said, I'm also in conversation with sound studies, right? And one of the things that's very important to remember is that during World War II, for a variety of reasons, but mostly, like I said, for the fear that the anti-colonial movement will use radio as a form of loudspeaker for the movement, there were not many radio receivers in India at the time, which meant that not many people could actually tune to Subhash Chandra Bose's voice. So it's very easy to dismiss that as unimportant, right? Well, maybe the voice was not longer unimportant, but I show how in reality, not tuning in did not mean that radio was not important. It just meant that there was a certain type of broadcasting that had to be done that encouraged talk about Subhash Chandra Bose, that encouraged people to talk about these radio broadcasts. So that also forces us to see the medium of radio differently. And in the context of radio studies, it becomes a really interesting way to think about how radio connects with audiences. And I try to connect that to the afterlife of Subhash Chandra Bose following his death, right? And to all the rumors around his death, how those rumors were also connected to his radio broadcasts.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, as I was reading the chapter, I could see the importance and significance of your intervention in terms of the study of Subhash Chandra Bose. So I found that to be like really fascinating to read. And I also found it very interesting how you were sort of comparing him to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And I found that to be a very interesting comparison, as you were mentioning that, you know, like, although the number of people listening to the radio might be very low in India, but actually there was like, you know, his sort of broadcasts were not just like the audience was not just limited to those who were listening, but it was sort of spread more further throughout India. So I found that to be very fascinating as well.
So they can definitely be compared as media personalities, right, that were made and created by the radio. So I think that's the important part. But I think that what a study of Subhash Chandra Bose as a radio personality does, that is somewhat controversial and yet extremely important for me to state directly, is that it simply aligns him a lot closer to the fascist governments that sponsored him. And I think that that is something that historians have shied away, and that it's time that we don't shy away, that it's time that we address directly. And radio sources make that very clear.
Thank you. So in the next section of your book, you shift your focus to the post-independence period. And in chapter 3, you analyze the role of radio and music in fashioning ideas of Indian culture and conditioning Indian citizenship in the 1950s and early 1960s. So could you tell us more about this and what you discuss in this chapter?
Sure. So the second section of the book looks specifically at no longer at news, but now at music. And that's also sort of part of the argument. I would say that during World War II, radio was most important as a provider of news. News continued to be important in a later time period and in the post-independence period. But right now, what becomes sort of a form of controversy and a form of discussion is its role as a provider of music, as a medium for music. So in the first chapter, I looked at the role and discussions about classical music and classical music in early post-colonial India and a reform campaign that takes place in All India Radio by... Again, led by many people, but I would say spearheaded, right, by B.B. Keskar, the Information and Broadcasting Minister. And it was a radio campaign, a reform campaign that tried to create new citizens for New India through through radio broadcasting and specifically through music. And it was by the promotion of classical music against what he saw as lesser forms of music. And the major lesser form of music was Hindi film songs, right? So that chapter talks about that campaign and the desire to make this particular kind of citizen that was based on auditory experience.
Thank you. So then the converse to this is the unique role of Radio Ceylon, which you discuss in chapter four. So this Radio Ceylon was a major transmitter of popular songs and film music across borders in South Asia. So could you tell us a little bit about its significance? Like, how did a radio station based in Ceylon, that's present-day Sri Lanka, which is a non-Hindi-Urdu linguistic region, become so important in Hindi-Urdu radio broadcasting?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, one of the parts of the book where sort of the story of Radio Ceylon is everywhere. It's impossible to talk to anyone really over the age of, I would say, 50, and mention the word radio and not hear Radio Ceylon or Amin Sayani's favorite program, Binaka Getmala. And yet there was so little scholarship and talk about it. But the station was based in Ceylon and now Sri Lanka. And it was based there because it was originally had a very strong transmitter that was used for broadcasting for British soldiers stationed in Asia. And when Ceylon became independent, commercial station was built on that. And one of the places that it broadcast, it was to India and Pakistan. And following Bibi Keskar's campaign, which I outlined in the previous chapter, right, which tried to create Hindustani classical music and to a lesser extent, Carnatic classical music as the national music, and took away Hindi film songs from the airwaves, Radio Ceylon took that and began a number of radio programs and very creative radio programs using Hindi film songs. And it sort of just, Keskar's campaign opened up a window for them that allowed them to really take advantage of it. And it was, I would say, among the, if not the most popular radio station throughout South Asia for at least two decades. And it played an incredibly important role in making Hindi film songs as popular and as important as we know them now. So the chapter talks about the history of the radio station, but also specifically talks about the ways in which it allowed these songs to circulate on the radio and the ways in which various radio stations created particular forms of listening. And I talk about how forms of listening to film in South Asia and forms of listening to film songs throughout South Asia are not natural. They were sort of created and explained and taught through these radio programs. And the station was as popular in neighboring Pakistan as it was in India. So the book also grapples with that. So how is it that in this time period that partition had created a division that it made it impossible for families to cross borders, you still had a very important shared soundscape?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you for sharing that. As I mentioned to you before the interview, like even my mother, for example, was remembering Radio Ceylon. So, I mean, I think the people of a certain generation in India and Pakistan would have fond memories and nostalgia about this radio station. So In chapter 5, you focus on Radio Pakistan's radio broadcasting during the 1965 Indo-Pakistan War. So could you tell us a little more about this conflict, as well as the significance and consequences of Radio Pakistan's coverage of the war in Pakistan?
Sure, absolutely. So as I mentioned, each section focuses on a genre and the importance of that genre at that time period. And in each section, I also outline the ways in which a government, a state government, whether it was the colonial government or the Indian or later now the Pakistani government, tried to use radio for their own means. And then I show the ways in which that was contested later on and how that takes place. So in this particular section, I turn to radio drama, actually more generally what I call dramatic radio. Mm-hmm. And the chapter 5 deals specifically with the 1965 war. And the 1965 war is something for which we really had or and continue to have very little scholarship about. It's often considered a military conflict that takes place in 1965 between India and Pakistan. It is an important moment because it really is the moment when the border is solidified, when it becomes mm-hmm. very hard on the western border to cross back and forth. But it's not sort of considered a major military conflict. And what I clearly became very clear to me from my number of interviews is that it was a very important media moment. So I was able to access recordings from the 1965 war and analyze those recordings and talk about how this war was created and was experienced through radio broadcasts and the role of a number of Radio Pakistan actors, singers, as well as writers throughout Pakistan, famous personalities played during those 17 days of war, as it's often referred to. And a very important character in that chapter is the role of Noor Jahan, the singer, the playback singer and actress, and her important role in performing songs live during the war on the radio, right? And it really does become a radicalizing moment where Pakistan emerges, right, as a moment of national pride. And the chapter talks about the ways in which radio enabled the creation of that.
Thank you. Absolutely. I mean, I can see how the significance of this chapter and sort of, you know, shining a light on an aspect of post-colonial South Asian history that has been sort of not as well studied as it should be.
Sorry, a note on sources here that might be interesting. So what I had been able to talk to a lot of radio broadcasters and interview a number of people in the 1965 war, and I was able to access Radio Pakistan's broadcasts for that. I just couldn't find anything that could help me make sense of the military conflict, and I needed to read something against that. What I was able, and ironically, I found it at my institution. where I did my PhD at UT Austin has the LBJ Library, and LBJ was president during that time period, and I was able to access the State Department sources for that to just get a sense of the military conflict going on there. So anyways, it was something that my people might find interesting.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think many historians would sort of be intrigued by how you sort of, I mean, it is, maybe other historians have also had the experience of discovering sources in unexpected places. So that's a really interesting story, and maybe others can relate. So in chapter 6, you analyze AIR's, that's All India Radio's Urdu service in the 1960s and 1970s, which you mentioned was a counter to Radio Pakistan's successful propaganda. So at a time when the Indo-Pakistan border became solidified, which you just mentioned, this AIR Urdu service became a space of contact and dialogue between both sides. So could you tell us more about what you discuss and analyze in this chapter?
Sure, absolutely. So while India certainly responded during the 1965 war, and there were broadcasts during the 1965 war, there was a sense among radio broadcasters as well as politicians that when it comes to a media war, Radio Pakistan had won in that sense. And There was also a very clear separation that takes place in 1965 with the border solidified. Mm-hmm. So there was a sense in India that there was no way to reach the Pakistani audience to explain events from an Indian perspective. So in response to that, Indira Gandhi, when she becomes prime minister in 1966, and actually a little earlier when she was actually Minister of Information and Broadcasting, she begins what is called the All India Radio Urdu Service. And the All India Radio Urdu Service began really as a news program. And it was meant to talk about ceasefire negotiations from an Indian perspective and to broadcast those to Pakistan on the medium wave to ensure that audiences in Pakistan could get away from the propaganda that they were getting from Radio Pakistan and have a sense of what India has. Broadcasters quickly realized that if they wanted anyone to listen to it, they needed to have some entertainment programs, and they began to add Hindi film songs. Mm-hmm. And then within less than 8 months, it was a nine-hour program going on. And while the initial aim of the program was to have Urdu understanding, I wouldn't say necessarily speaking, but Urdu understanding audiences in Pakistan, it quickly gained a lot of popularity among audiences in India. And while that was never what the funding was for, broadcasters took advantage of that. And they designed programs that were meant for listeners on both sides of the divide. And what the chapter does is looks at the popularity of these programs, specifically looks at the role of letters, because what the AIR Urdu Broadcasting Program, AIR Urdu Service becomes famous for is for their letter exchange programs that allows for listeners in India and listeners in Pakistan to send letters to the radio station. Those letters were read by broadcasters on the airwaves and to speak about those letters on the airwaves and to put that as a connection at a time when physically crossing the border had become all but impossible. And the chapter analyzes the role of those letters, the role of those programs, and looks at specifically issues of language and the ways in which it was enabled to build connections at that time period.
Thank you. So in the conclusion to the book, you discuss how by the 1980s, radio began to be overshadowed by other media like television and the cassette, bringing an end to the golden age of radio. So could you tell us a little more about this and some of the ways in which paying attention to radio broadcasting changes our understanding of 20th century South Asian history?
Okay. I don't think I said bringing an end to the golden age of radio, because I think that in the age of cassettes and in the age of television, radio is no longer at the center in the ways it was all the way to the late 70s, very early 1980s that I put forward, but it remains very important. Mm-hmm. So I end the story there because the book specifically covers what I would say the peak years of Hindi Urdu broadcasting at the time period. Sorry, I forgot the second part of your question.
It's about how paying attention to radio broadcasting changes our understanding of 20th century South Asian history.
So I think it does so. Yes, absolutely. I think it does so in a number of ways. One of the ways which it does is paying attention to periodization and what we consider important. Paying attention to radio broadcasting makes us, for example, look at the importance of World War II as a pivotal moment in South Asian mm-hmm. history. It makes us look at Subhash Chandra Bose in a very different perspective if we pay attention to radio broadcasting. And it forces us to hear him the way that people heard him, which was in the context of Axis propaganda to India and what it means to hear his voice in that context. Paying attention to radio sources doesn't mean that the 1947 partition did not take place, but it does mean that there were connections post-1947 and that the histories of India and Pakistan need to continue to be read and studied together mm-hmm. After that time period. And it forces us to do that. When it comes to a linguistic history, like I said, the assumption and the belief is that Hindustani is killed after 1947. This book shows that Hindustani actually thrived on the airwaves, and it might have been one of its strongest moments if we listen to radio broadcasting. As your mom remembers, Radio Ceylon was crucial to the 50s and the 60s, right? So that means Radio Ceylon was a Hindustani broadcasting radio station. So Hindustani remains well and alive in the 50s and 60s. It also forces us to look at the 1965 war. I would say that to understand what takes place in 1971, we need to see the really importance of 1965 as a moment of building that and the ways in which West Pakistan creates this kind of version of nationalism that completely excludes East Pakistan. You can't really understand how that takes place if you don't pay attention to how that takes place in the most important medium of communication at the time period, which was radio, right, in 1965 and the creation of that war. And you can only do that if you actually listen to the broadcasts and talk to the people that heard them. So it forces you to rethink the role of 1965 to do that. So, and then I would say, I mean, at the end of it, it forces you to really think about, the book doesn't argue that partition did not take place. The book argues that there were many ways in which listeners and broadcasters kept on pulling at that and found ways to live with that, and that it's our job to sort of listen to that in the same way that people did at the time period.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, I see all of that as being like, all of those as being like major contributions of your book. This sort of shift from just focusing on 1947 and the partition to all seeing the significance of World War II, and also seeing the continued role, the continuities in terms of, for example, like the role of Hindustani as a sort of a language that sort of continued existing and making connections across borders in South Asia, and of course the significance of wars like 1965 and so on, and sort of influencing how history sort of turned out in 20th century South Asia. So today I'm speaking to you via podcast, which is a burgeoning audio media, but one could say that currently audio media could be said to be undergoing a renaissance. So as a South Asia studies scholar and as a sound studies scholar, would you like to share any thoughts about this?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I would say it's one of the most exciting moments to really write a history of radio, because it's for a number of reasons. I have to say it's also an exciting moment to be a historian of media, period. When I first began presenting this research prior to Trump's election, often in history departments and in history conferences, I would be asked, why does it matter? I don't think anyone can, why does this matter to political events? Right? I don't think anyone can really ask that anymore. It's sort of, it's absolutely incapable of asking. But it's a particularly exciting moment to work on sonic media because of the revival that we're having. And I think it forces us to really think about what it meant in the past. It's not the same then now, but we can certainly feel and know why it's important. I mean, one way in which I tell students about this is to study the 20th century without paying attention to radio. It's like trying to have someone write a history of the pandemic and not think of Zoom. And you will be like, where is it? Zoom is crucial to it, and not think of Zoom, right? So I think that that's how I would explain why I felt that this was so important.
Oh, that's a really interesting comparison that you bring up. And it sort of just underlines how interesting and important your book was. So thank you so much, Isabel, for taking so much time out of your busy schedule to talk with me today. Before we end, may I ask you what you are working on right now and what's next for you?
I'm working on a lot of things, but one of the things that I've been very interested in is in not only writing about my interlocutors, but writing with them. So currently at this very moment, I am working on an interview with one of the listeners that I work with very closely. His name is Hamras. So I'm working on an interview for that we hope to publish together. I'm also applying for a large grant to digitize some of the archives that I had that I was fortunate enough to access. So I've been working on that grant this particular year. And then finally, I mean, all of this is part of that material, but one of the things that I really want to sort of consider more for a second project is more in-depth study of radio drama and radio narratives that took place in the 70s and the 80s. both in Hindi and Urdu in India and Pakistan. And I'm specifically thinking more about the role of genre in that.
Thank you. That sounds really interesting. All of your projects, next projects, sound really fascinating, and I look forward to following up with your work. And I hope our audience, they read your book, they purchase and read your book, Radio for the Millions, and they also follow up with your work in the future. So this was an interview with Professor Isabel Wakuha Alonso about her new book, Radio for the Millions, Hindi-Urdu Broadcasting Across Borders, which was published by Columbia University Press in 2023. So thank you, Isabel.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much.